A Farm in Iowa by Shea Frotherdon, rated R, read by Hack Benjamin 22. John's grandpa dies July 27th, 6 days after he turns 82. He's buried long before the news reaches Antarctica, and John's left with a note from the minister who conducted the services, a newspaper clipping about the funeral, and the key to a farmhouse he hasn't seen since he was 12. The key's dull and scratched, and for reasons John doesn't entirely understand, he hopes this is the one his grandpa used to tuck under the doormat when he headed into town. He shoves it under his pillow and heads out to the chopper. There's nothing to be done about it now, and his grandpa always said work could cure pretty much anything. He takes a supply run, does his best not to think about Iowa overmuch, but there's only 2 months left of his tour, and suddenly there's some place he can go when he's through. A lifetime in the military has made him good at pushing away unwanted thoughts, but this time none of the usual tricks seem to work. He lies awake at night, kept from sleep by memories of summers flecked with gold and the sting of bug bites in the late afternoon. He can't decide if everything he remembers is soaked with sunlight because he's tired of freezing, or because his memories are sepia-toned. By the time he packs his duffel and checks his locker for the last time, he's still not entirely accepted what he's about to do. But 4 days later, he's in a cab, $46 on the meter and rising, speeding down a county road, looking for the farmhouse around every September bend. The farm has seen better days. There are only 80 acres left now, rented out. They'll bring in enough to keep the farmhouse in repair, but there's no real livelihood to be coaxed from such a small plot of soil. He could rent the pasture out, but he already knows he'll keep that for himself. Hoard the sun-warm tangle of ditch lilies in June, the riot of grasses that'll grow thigh-high by next August, sweet-smelling and dusty to brush against his jeans. The barn is still standing, sweetly aged, the weathered red of a knowing blush, and as he pushes a handful of 20s at the cab driver, he wonders if the old tractor is still working, if he'll even need it on this uneven patch of land. The key slips into the lock with an easy familiarity, and the door swings open into dark, musty heat. John crosses the room without thinking to raise a blind, open the window, and let in a breeze. For a moment it's overwhelming, the press of memory, the lure that's pulled him back, so he moves to raise every blind, open every window, let a little life back into a house that seems to be holding its breath. Things have changed since the last time he was here. The couch is bigger, the fridge brand new, the kitchen walls white instead of yellow. But so much is the same, it's hard to grasp that he's full-grown and owns the place. The knitted blanket on the back of the sofa is the same one he claimed for himself when he was 7. The wall clock still ticks with a measured solemnity. The tread on the 4th step from the top of the stairs creaks a familiar warning. Beneath the twin bed in the smallest bedroom, he can run his fingers over the spot where he carved his initials. JS8473. Waiting out a storm that he'd have died rather than admit made him crawl beneath the bed frame out of fear. He sleeps on the couch for the first few days, empties the wardrobe of his grandpa's clothes, donates what's useful, and hauls away the rest. He rummages in the basement and finds enough paint to make the bedroom look more like something he can claim as his own, takes down all the pictures, and makes up the bed. Despite the stash of money in John's saving account, there's nothing to buy in Antarctica after all. He's leery of spending too much at once, sinks some into fitting the bathroom with its first shower, and rebuilds a sagging porch that runs two sides of the house. Most everything else can wait. The roof's in good shape, and the siding's weathered but solid. There's no AC, but it's mid-October, and the nights are cool even if the days are still warm. In November, he discovers that the heat doesn't really make it through the vents to the bedroom, but he'd always been the sort to burrow beneath a dozen blankets, so he doesn't count it as a hardship. He meets his neighbors, accepts an invitation to dinner, helps one repair 6, nearly 7 miles of fences before the winter shows up, and in return he finds the lane from the road plowed after every first snowfall. That's the kind of deal a man can savor, standing by the window, coffee in hand, listening to the radio announcer tell him the wind chill's 30 below. Come spring, he feels restless, decides he's going to grow something if it kills him. He buys seeds, tills a vegetable garden, and cheerfully plants whatever comes to mind without a clue what he's doing. He sticks onions in the dirt the wrong way up on his first try, and wonders why they pop out of their furrows as if making a getaway attempt. Tomatoes work out better, as do potatoes and beets, but the deer eat his corn, and rabbits eat his radishes. The second year he grows peppers, and heroically manages not to pull the carrots up to see how they're doing more than once or twice. He uses the tractor more than he thought he would, hauling logs from the creek to the house, pulling out a stump from the furthest pasture. She's a steady piece of machinery, chugs where John's used to speed, but she puts up with his attempts to tinker beneath the hood, and seems to respond when he croons endearments. He stores her in the barn between trips, the building leaning south like it yearns for warmer winters, submitting with grace to retirement of hay bales and raccoons in the eaves. John can't help but pat the door when he enters in an afternoon, pressing his hand to sun-warmed wood and absorbing the scent of sawdust and patience. There's a coffee can on the shelf above the stove, slowly filling with loose change and the odd $5 bill. He's written bike on a strip of tape he stuck to the front. There's a Triumph dealership in Dubuque, and by God, he'll save up enough money the military hasn't touched to buy one, he swears. Skim along these back roads like he's flying. It's a while before he feels like he's found a rhythm to living among these different shades of brown and green. He learns to fix things, gets a reputation for being handy, and pretty soon the odd jobs that roll his way mean his savings are put aside for emergencies, and the fridge is always stocked with beer. He dreams of his bike, but savors the way the feels roll by when he's driving his grandpa's truck, a 48 Dodge that has no business holding together, but refuses, like the barn and the tractor and the house, to give up the ghost when there's work could be done. There are two lone corn cobs in the back of the truck when John arrives at the farm that first September. He leaves them there with a nod to his grandpa, and lays his baseball bat beside them. It's good to have a little company when he drives, and a guy never knows when he might need to play ball. It's spring, and he's fixing the tractor when he hears it, the familiar thud, 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 of a car with a tire that's about to blow. He ducks out from beneath the hood, squints into the early evening sun, and lifts a hand to his eyes, watching the sedan come into view, wondering why the driver isn't slowing. He can see from the color of the plates that the car's not local, frowns at the speed it's going, and despite himself, flinches when the inevitable happens, and the road's showered with strips of rubber in a spectacular show. He pulls a rag from the back pocket of his jeans, works on getting the worst of the oil from his hands as he jogs up the lane, headed toward the car that's nose-deep in the ditch. He's still 15 feet away when the driver's door is flung open, and the guy inside catapults out, yelling a stream of incomprehensible babble at a pitch that suggests he's really fucking annoyed. "You all right?" John calls, closing the distance between them. "All right!" The driver's quivering with indignation or shock or something, his face an unnatural shade of pink. "Do I seem like I'd be all right? My car is in a ditch. What sort of roads do you people have out here? Is this a trick? A lure? A test for people who don't know their way around your... He gestures as if to take in everything around them. The oak trees by the creek, the wide open fields, the farmhouse, and dismiss them all out of hand. John quirks an eyebrow. "John Shepherd," he says, extending a mostly clean hand. "Shepherd, of course. How appropriate. With the rural farming." The driver's words fade into an exasperated sigh. "Dr. Rodney McKay." He shakes John's hand and promptly wipes his palm down his own trousers, leaving a smear of oil behind. John valiantly doesn't show his amusement. This guy's a trip. "Need a phone?" McKay waves a hand and digs into his jacket pocket, brandishing a cell phone as if it's something John might not have seen before. "I have one, thank you." John waits for him to work out that they're out of range of any tower. "What do you mean there's no signal?" McKay splutters at his phone, as if it might have an answer for him. "Where the hell am I?" "Cedar County," John says blandly. "This is ridiculous, but it's also pretty fun. Maybe my landline'll help." "Landline." McKay says the words as if they're roughly the equivalent of smallpox. "Sure." He follows John back along the road and down the lane, obviously completely out of his element, twitching when something inquisitive buzzes too close. "You have mechanics out here, I assume," he asks. Oh, yeah, John nods blithely. Of course, it's after hours now, and no one's open on Sundays, but... This is the 21st century, McKay hisses. Yep. John's sorely tempted to pull a long stalk of grass from the edge of the pasture and start chewing on it just for effect. But Bob and Jim are your regular God-fearing sort of folk. They'll help you out on Monday. McKay says something, probably unpleasant, beneath his breath. It's a rental car, he observes tightly. I have 24-hour roadside assistance for which I paid a premium, and someone will no doubt be here within the hour. John makes a small skeptical noise. What? McKay snaps. Nothing. Phone's right here. John opens the kitchen door, ushers McKay inside, points to the phone, and gets himself a beer. He steps back outside to give the man a little privacy to experience his searing disappointment in the value of add-on services, and sits on the porch steps, savoring the breeze. When McKay starts yelling, he swears it makes the beer taste better. There's silence for a good few minutes once the yelling stops, and John's just about to go investigate when the screen door opens again. I wonder... McKay seems to be fidgeting. It's just that I'm hypoglycemic, you see, and stress can be a factor in bringing on episodes, and my blood sugar's no doubt plummeting into ranges that only... John waves a reassuring hand. First cabinet on your left. Go to town. McKay nods and disappears. John's content to sit on the stoop and finish his beer for all of 30 seconds before his curiosity wins out. There's a manic level of rustling going on in the kitchen, and it's possible McKay's a doctor of medieval murder techniques for all John knows. So he sticks his head around the doorframe and bites back a smile as McKay eats what looks to be his 6th Reese's peanut butter cup in a row. Better? John asks. It's debatable, McKay says, licking the wrapper morosely. So your rental company, John says, reaching to pull McKay a beer from the fridge. Coming out, right? McKay stiffens and lifts his chin. There are apparently no available vehicles in the vicinity. They'll call me back. He looks a little shamefaced. If you don't mind me waiting. Not at all. Stoop's nicer. Unless you've got a thing for doing someone else's dishes. McKay squints at him. Sure. The whatever seems implied. They settle on the stoop, tugging at beers, and John's happy with the silence. McKay's clearly not. John bets himself an extra hour in bed in the morning that McKay's gonna break and rant about the roads, or the mechanics, or the... What sort of place is this that you don't have cell phone coverage? McKay explodes. Cell phone towers any second. 8 a.m. it is. Starts again about 15 minutes down the road, John says, gesturing with his beer bottle. And I don't talk on the phone so much these days. It's a basic tenet of civilization, McKay argues, gesturing wildly and spilling beer on his shoe. A means of modern global communication without which the exchange of ideas and information on which we build any notion of progress would be utterly crippled. A tower's a mere matter of steel beams and wiring. Given an afternoon, I could probably raise one myself. No wonder people choose to fly over this part of the country. John raises an eyebrow. So why were you driving? He asks dryly. That's classified, McKay answers, his words precise and clipped. John looks at him. Classified? I'm sorry, do I look like a speaking spell? I believe I was quite clear. Military? McKay shudders. Please. Although I have had the misfortune to work beside members of certain research divisions from time to time. John feels a knot between his shoulders slowly ease. So you're... He searches for the profession that seems best suited to making McKay break out into hives. Not a doctor of art history, I take it. It's impressive how far McKay can spit. Down Mitch's bar, he'd be a favorite, save for the crease-resistant khaki pants and the ill-matching sports coat. I hold PhDs in physics and mechanical engineering, thank you very much. 2 separate PhDs. John nods. Huh. McKay stares at him and twitches. I'm sorry, would an associate's degree in sheep excrement from the local extension office have been more impressive? Wasn't aware you were trying to impress me, McKay, John drawls, and delights in the flash of frustration that shows on McKay's face. And what exactly do you do, Mr. Shepherd? Tinker. John shrugs lackadaisically, just to be irritating. I was fixing my tractor when you hurtled into my ditch. A task for which I'm sure your GED was a great advantage. Nah, John swigs his beer. But my degree in math from MIT sometimes comes in handy. McKay actually manages to spit further this time, and John narrows his eyes, wondering if there's a technique to that. MIT? McKay splutters. Sure. John scratches the back of his neck. And then, you know, advanced study in the Air Force. They kinda like you to understand physics before they put you in one of their shiny planes. Air Force? Ronnie sounds a little ragged around the edges. Major. John looks at him and smiles. How you doing? The car company doesn't call and doesn't call, so McKay calls them 4 times in the next hour. Each time he ends up on hold, and John lets himself grin when McKay starts criticizing Avis's choice of classical music and argues with a recorded voice about whether his call is actually important at all. John has to intervene the 5th time McKay gets shuffled into some interminable queue. His phone, he reckons from the blood-curdling yell of frustration McKay emits, is 30 seconds away from a violent death it doesn't deserve. He makes a start on dinner. McKay gnaws on a thumbnail, glaring at the phone, but quickly gets distracted when onions hit the pan. You're not cooking anything with citrus, are you? I have intense allergies to citrus. John looks over his shoulder. Wanna stay for dinner, McKay? He asks. Oh, well, yes, I just assumed, since they haven't called back and have no other means to reach me or to retrieve their car, which, by the way, is nothing but a gigantic testimony to the inferior workmanship of American engineers. If they'd had something German, like I asked, none of this would be happening, except perhaps the part with back roads. But that's entirely the fault of this godforsaken state and its shoddy system of signposts, which are really completely misleading about simple requirements such as gas. If you signpost gas at the next exit, does that mean someone should be required to drive 30 miles into the naked wilderness to fill their tank? It does not! Are garages by the side of the highways illegal in this state? Do you have moral objections? Clearly, the least the rental company could have done is supply a compass if this was the uncharted back of beyond they were sending me into. Something to aid me in addition to my usually impeccable sense of direction, which was only thrown off by an ill-timed bag of Doritos in the glare of the sun. Someone, by the way, should see to the height of those road signs. They're a hazard at certain times of day, completely impossible to read. No wonder I took a wrong turn and ended up here, and... His face pales. If my tire hadn't blown, who knows where I'd have been? Feasting with the Amish, lost to the scientific community, my insights withheld from humanity forever. He sits down heavily on a stool. John blinks. Pasta's all right, then? Yes, thank you. McKay stares off into space, apparently consumed by the prospect of his doom in a pre-industrial society. So how long have you lived here? McKay asks over dinner. John shrugs. Couple years, since my grandpa died. McKay looks at him quizzically. Doesn't make the obvious leap. It was his place, John explains. My mom grew up here. We came here on vacations and stuff till I was 12. And then what happened? McKay stuffs pasta into his mouth with a minimum of grace. John looks at his plate. My mom died that fall. My dad wouldn't let me come back after that. He's no idea why he's telling McKay all of this. Things his neighbors don't know and haven't asked. Perhaps it's the freedom of knowing McKay will be gone before long. Confession, good for the soul, all that junk. He glances at McKay, who's chasing the last tube of penne around his plate and wearing sauce on the lapel of his shirt. Funniest looking stand-in for a man of cloth John's ever seen. McKay glances in his direction. Trouble with your dad? That's just downright eerie. He's surely not said enough to communicate that much to a stranger. He shrugs again and reaches for his beer. Maybe. I couldn't stand my parents, McKay offers cheerfully. They started it. Hated each other so intensely it was only a matter of time before it spilled over to my sister and me. He mops at his plate with a hunk of bread. Of course, the shouting stopped eventually, and then it was all frigid silence and disapproving looks over the top of the newspaper. Couldn't wait to get away. John nods, understanding. Something like that. I'll win a Nobel someday. Okay. McKay waves his bread. Sorry. Segue. Lost art. I mean, I'm brilliant. It's a foregone conclusion I'll win one eventually. but in this instance, I mean I'll win one just so that I can fail to thank them from the podium. He smiles wistfully. They're dead, of course, so the shock value's lessened. But I'm petty enough that I'll still do it, just for me. He puts down his bread. A little for Jeannie. Sister? John nods, pushing his plate away. He was the only family I had left. McKay nods as if he understands. You should stay. McKay tilts his chin again. The gesture is already becoming familiar. I'm sure there's a hotel nearby. One? No, there isn't. Two? How would you get there if there was? And three? The car company still doesn't know where else to reach you. There's a major interstate. 40 miles away as the crow flies, sure. And there have to be hotels. Hotels are a mainstay of the American compulsion to drive places when there are so many other ways you could travel in greater comfort and with less opportunity for getting lost in the middle of nowhere. Not this again. About an hour that way. John points toward the far end of the living room. Are the Quad Cities. Likely you've drove through them. Mississippi River ring a bell? Plenty of hotels out there. But the trouble is, it's the national sales meeting for John Deere this weekend, and they bought up every hotel in a 30-mile radius 2 years in advance. Always do. But about an hour that way, John points in the other direction, is Iowa City. But it's graduation weekend at the U, and if you think there's a square inch of space someone hasn't already overpaid for, you're out of your mind. But I've a spare room, and you can call the car company tomorrow morning, early as you please. And if you're afraid I'll make a play for your virtue, you can take the couch. The stairs creak. You'll hear me coming with the axe if that's the way my blood runs. Ronnie pales. I hadn't considered axe murder. Well, I'm covering all the bases for you, okay? John scrubs at his face, tired and bamboozled by the events of the last 5 hours. Seriously, McKay, I won't kill you to sleep in a real bed. But if you're afraid about the damn thing out of citrus, go ahead and sleep in your car. My car's in a ditch. So take the damn bed, John says with exaggerated patience, spreading his hands. McKay tightens his jaw. Do you have coffee? John squints. What? Coffee, a bean grown in warm climes the world over, historically a popular cash crop in Brazil, but my preference is for Hawaiian beans when they're available, though Kenyan would be acceptable. Folgers do? He knows before he says it, McKay's going to have an apoplectic fit. But it's such an easy pitch, hanging right there over the plate. McKay has the look of a man who's seen the edge of civilization and stared into the abyss. Relax, McKay. 2 bags of top-quality beans in the freezer that even you won't be able to find fault with. What do you think I am, a Philistine? He glances at McKay. Don't answer that. Well, all things considered, perhaps I should accept your offer of hospitality. Thank God. You're a stubborn freak. Thank you. Wasn't a compliment. I have an irritating knack for finding compliments where they're not intended. John stares. Shut off the light and follow me, he says at last. Despite his resolution to sleep in until 8, John's wide awake at 6, and by 7 he's brewed a second pot of coffee for McKay and scribbled a note. Working in the barn, help yourself to whatever breakfast you can forage. There's a wireless if you want to fire up your laptop while you're waiting for Avis. He takes a walk around the perimeter of the garden first, checks for damage done overnight, and figures it'll be another couple of weeks before the spinach'll be ready to pull. He leans on the fence by the pasture for a while, savoring the last of his coffee, and only wanders to the barn when the cup's good and empty. He slides open the heavy doors and smiles as the sharp scent of fresh-cut wood rises up to greet him. The chair he's trying to build's a labor of love, an idea that got stuck in his head the October before. Like the vegetable patch, it's an experiment, a muddle of trial and error. The fireplace did well over the winter with the scraps of wood he broke or sawed off too short. But now it's beginning to look like something, like a rocking chair, meant for the porch, for his grandpa's memory and all the unfinished family business that got buried in a cemetery 10 miles down the road. John scratches his chin, Sunday stubble rough against his fingers, and shrugs off his jacket. The plane's where he left it the week before, and he checks the blade, smooths a hand down the length of the rail that's gripped into the vise. He bends his body and shaves a sliver from the wood, crafting his piece one stroke at a time. "You have wireless," Kay splutters when John steps back into the kitchen. John blinks and dusts his palms against his jeans, flecks of sawdust falling to the floor. "Yeah?" He moves to the sink, turns on the faucet, and reaches for the soap to wash off his hands. "You don't have cell phone coverage, but you have wireless," McKay presses. "DSL line. Rather. Easy enough." "But it's..." "We like the Pony Express just fine," John drawls, drying his hands and leaning a hip against the counter. "But the cost of the feed was killing us." McKay's mouth sets into a thin line, and he types furiously for a couple of seconds, long enough for John to notice that the coffee pot is still mostly full. He bet good money it's because it's the third pot brewed that day. "Avis call?" he asks, reaching for a clean mug. "Yes." McKay tilts his chin in what's rapidly becoming a trademark fashion. "They can have a car for me tomorrow at 8 a.m. "Tomorrow, huh?" "And I called hotels. I've left a 20 under the phone book because there were rather a lot of them, and..." "You're right. There's nowhere." John shrugs a nonchalant, "Told you so." "So you're saying you need to stay another night?" McKay looks ready to seize. "It seems so." "It's fine by me." John's puzzled to realize it really is fine by him, that he doesn't find McKay's Arabic bundle of academic hypertension nearly as annoying as he probably should. He chews on his lip, looking out over the back pasture, wondering what that says about how much time he spends alone. "Perhaps there's a diner or something. I could take you to dinner as a thank you." McKay speaks stiffly, as if he's walking over hot coals while he talks. John considers the idea. "Sure." He sips his coffee. "The Cubs are playing tonight. We could watch the game." "Baseball?" "Of course baseball." McKay rolls his eyes. "I will never understand your nation's obsession with such a slow-moving, drawn-out, lingering travesty that masquerades as a sport." "Whoa." John sets down his mug. "With the warm-ups and the throwing and the catching and the striking out and the once-in-a-blue-moon someone hitting anything," McKay sniffs. "Hockey. Now there's a sport where you're guaranteed speed, precision, and stick-on-puck action from one end of the period to the other." "If you're about to start quoting poetry about men who throw other men against plexiglass..." "Baseball's such a ridiculous waste of time," McKay shoots back, gesturing with one hand. "Hours and hours in uncomfortable seats and the singing and the stretching and the unfathomably bad beer." "Oh, that's it," John says and grabs for the keys to the truck. "Get a move on." McKay freezes. "What?" "I said, get a move on. It's after 12 already." "Oh my God," McKay says weakly. "You're actually an axe murderer, aren't you? An axe murderer who snaps when someone questions his fixation with baseball." John rolls his eyes. "McKay, what's really out in that barn of yours? How many other unfortunate souls have you lured in with promises of phone calls only to beat them senseless with a baseball bat and sacrifice their bodies to the infield fly gods?" "We're going on a little trip, that's all," John soothes, hands held up, palms out toward Rodney. "That's what they always say. I've seen Miller's Crossing." "What? Children of the Corn?" "How much coffee did you have exactly?" McKay looks at his laptop as if he's wishing his next of kin goodbye. "Just promise me it'll be quick." John points toward the kitchen door. "Now." McKay calms down a lot when John buys him a packet of Hostess cupcakes at the gas station, and before they've made it the 30 miles or so to Highway 151, he's babbling inanities about electromagnetic radiation and the true capacity of the human eye to discern color, all while drinking in the limitless blue of the afternoon sky and scattering cake crumbs the length and breadth of the cab. John shakes his head and turns on the radio. He flips past the ball games, not wanting to squander his hands so soon, and winces at the bubblegum pop that assaults his ears for 3 seconds before he can think to move the dial. He's almost at the end of the spectrum when he catches the familiar opening notes of Folsom Prison Blues, and grins wickedly. McKay flinches and looks at him out of the corner of his eye. "Come on, McKay. Johnny Cash. You gotta love Johnny Cash." "Oh, yes, of course," McKay drawls. John throws him a look and starts to sing along, lamenting about time dragging on and the train rolling by to San Antone. McKay's eyebrows shoot up toward his receding hairline, but John just taps along on the steering wheel, enjoying the rhythmic thud of the road beneath the wheels of the truck, and the warm breeze blowing through the partially open window. "But I shot a man in Reno, just to watch him die," McKay throws in, enunciating the words like a Hollywood movie announcer. John almost drives the truck off the road in surprise, and McKay smirks with satisfaction. "Are we there yet?" McKay whines as John pulls off 136, heading out past the outskirts of Dyersville into open farm country. There's nothing showing in the fields yet, save for the stubble from last year's corn harvest, and the road's in spectacularly poor shape. "Almost. I almost wish you'd killed me. I'd be out of my misery," McKay mutters, opening another Reese's peanut butter cup and munching morosely. "Like I said, almost there," says John, making a right on Lansing Way. "I could have spent the afternoon productively heckling the car company to upgrade me to a better vehicle in return for leaving me stranded," McKay fusses. "I could have made the next move on my game of online chess with Zelenka. He'd never have seen it coming. He always underestimates me, the night-loving Czechoslovakian son of a..." John slows to make the left and realizes he has all of McKay's attention for once. "It's real?" McKay asks, dumbfounded. "Pretty much," John replies, and rumbles down the gravel road to Lansing Farm, pulling to a stop next to a beaten-up station wagon and a brand-new minivan, beside a baseball field that in 4 months will be surrounded by corn. "How is it real?" McKay asks, fumbling with the door handle and getting hurriedly out of the truck, staring at the rickety bleachers, the familiar white farmhouse, the red dirt pitcher's mound. John hides a smile as he rummages behind his seat for his glove and a couple of baseballs that have seen better days. "Want to catch?" he asks, reaching into the bed of the truck for his bat. "We can? Are we allowed?" McKay asks, blinking. "Sure," John nods at the kids who are reluctantly leaving the field, herded by their worn-out parents. "No good at baseball," McKay says, stunned. "Who cares?" John tosses a ball in the air and catches it. "We're just messing around." "It's real," McKay says again, and John can't help himself, laughs and tugs on McKay's shirt to get him moving, drags him past a notice board full of photos from when a movie crew descended in 1988. It's after 5 when they leave the field, and by the time they pull off the highway, head out on a country road that leads back to the farm, the sun is low in the sky. The trip back is strangely quiet. McKay slumped comfortably in the passenger seat, dirt on his neck, his hands, his pant legs, a grass-stained baseball in one hand. He doesn't quite smile, but John's so used to the babble of his discomfort, he reckons this must be some form of contentment he's seeing. The farm's in view when McKay clears his throat. "You should call me Rodney," he says, and John reckons perhaps they just decided they were friends. "Berkeley," Rodney says. "Good school." Rodney squints into the twilight for no good reason that John can fathom. Except for the students. John frowns. "Oh, yes, yes, I hear they're terribly bright," Rodney drawls dismissively. "Personally, I think that perception's entirely the result of an authoritarian PR campaign waged by the admissions office. If they were bright, I wouldn't have to keep failing them, would I? If they could read, perhaps, it would help. But no, they come to my office hours, day after day, whining that the book's so complicated, the chapters are so long. Of course it's complicated. It's physics. If they want simplicity, I'm sure the music department has intro to bongo thumping they can fill up their spare hours and vacant little minds with a helping of modern art." John snorts. "I bet your apartment's just plastered with Warhol." "You just make me hungry," Rodney sighs. "All those soup cans." John chuckles low, leaning back on his arms, the floor of the porch rough beneath his elbows. "At least you have cell phone coverage back home," he points out. a fact for which I will give devout thanks each and every day, until I forget. So Thursday. Seems fair. He ignores the small twist in his gut that suggests he doesn't think it's fair at all, and concentrates on the way the farm's fading into shadow as twilight deepens. Runny sighs. Considering we're in the middle of nowhere, without immediate access to foods containing partially hydrogenated oils, mechanics who understand the concept of customer service, lab space in which I can continue to push the boundaries of modern science, or newspapers whose managing editors are generally known by a first and last name. He drifts. This is almost bearable. Almost? Well, I can hardly expect to find my personal Shangri-La in the middle of a naked cornfield, can I? Rodney asks, beer bottle tilted emphatically. This is a wasteland, a desert that exists outside the parameters of meaningful intellectual exchange. A backwater. John nods considerately. I think the folks at the U might have a few words to say about that. Oh, please! It's the University of Iowa. Name one significant contribution made by any physicist at that institution. John takes a swig from his beer bottle. Van Allen's work on radiation belts that utilized the first Explorer mission? Oh. Rodney pauses. He was from here? Chair of the department from 51 to 85. Huh. John bites back a smile as silence swallows them whole, lets it spin out between them and follow them upstairs into two separate bedrooms. He lies awake, thinking of space travel and the last F-16 he flew, dreams about gravity pressing him back into his seat. Morning comes quickly, two pots of coffee strong. The new rental car shows up at 8 a.m., a tow truck on its tail, and by 8:15 the road's empty, May rising up to fill the hollow spaces left where the prairie grass is trampled. John chews his lip for a minute, then heads for the truck. Mrs. Yoder's been pressing him all winter to paint her house come spring, and the weather plans to hold for a few days yet. He can get a start, see what needs patching, maybe even make it into town for supplies if she's got a color picked out. His baseball bat's still on the bed of the truck, and he sets his jaw against something he can't quite pin down. Failing at self-reflection, he yanks the driver's door open, cranks the engine, pulls out into the road, and heads in the opposite direction to the one Rodney took. He finds his sense of humor by sundown, turns on the ball game, and toasts McKay with a beer. He sends the first postcard 15 days later to an address the Berkeley website's only too willing to supply. On one side of the postcard is a picture of a pig with half a corn cob hanging from its mouth. On the other, he scrawls a note. Struggling along in the backwater. Hope you made it to civilization, okay? J.S. Rodney's reply arrives after 23 days that John's not counting. A large manila envelope containing two journal articles from the International Journal of Modern Physics and a sheet of notepaper with 5 homework questions and a supplementary Leafs versus Sens, Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. John notices the envelope has a Colorado postmark, but Rodney hasn't corrected him about the address, so he sends the second postcard to Berkeley, too. Does the math on page 367 seem off to you? P.S. Your team sucks. 19 days later comes another article, a note asking exactly what he means by off, and a book about the Leafs with a post-it note on the front. They do not, you lackadaisical, loitering oaf. The postcards become a thing. John searches out the most tasteless pictures he can find, a surprising number of which involve pigs, combing the racks at the gas station and the grocery store. He finds a truly dazzling photo of a parade float one day, a giant ear of corn constructed kernel by kernel out of gallon milk jugs painted bright yellow, anchored to a hayrick and resplendent phallic glory. He fears he may have peaked after he sends it, but then finds a postcard of an I-80 rest stop, peopled entirely with extras from 1974, bedecked in polyester pants and shirts with collars so wide it's a wonder no one's lost an eye. In return, Rodney supplements the physics articles with the occasional study in mathematics or quantum mechanics, and twice the post-it note has crusted mashed potatoes smeared on the edge. John dates Donna Miller for almost the whole month of July, and relearns the feel of someone else's hands on his body. It ends badly, He laughs at a joke that turns out to be a sincere invitation to the church social, and winds up ass down in a patch of stinging nettles for his trouble. Things go better with Abby Brenneman, at least until she decides she's back with her ex, and then John's down one really reliable supplier of making out, and can't go back to Mitch's bar for 3 weeks until Brad's had enough beer to forget he wants to snap him like a twig. John's no slouch at a good honest brawl, but Brad's the size of a barn, and there are better things to do of an evening than run face first into his fist. Rodney's homework problems, for a start. Not that he'd ever give him the satisfaction of letting him know he's doing every one. At the beginning of August, John mails Rodney the Idiot's Guide to Football, on the suspicion that a man who dislikes baseball will fail to see the inherent beauty of a last-minute punt return without a little coaching. McKay sends back 2 packets of strange green candy, to which he says he's become addicted. A post-it, on which he's drawn a reasonable representation of himself flipping John the bird, and a scrap of paper scrawled with his home address, email, and a phone number. The postmark's Californian, and John doesn't ask about Colorado, but sends his own email address in return. Ronnie's first email's 2 lines long. Asks if the postcard manufacturers in Iowa really have nothing better to do than inflict photographs of pigs and corn upon the world. John writes back no. He's fairly sure the lack of capitalization will drive Rodney round the bend, and he isn't surprised to find a 5K screed on the importance of grammar in his inbox 2 mornings later, with a 3K PS on the imminent downfall of Western civilization as a special bonus prize. Late summer burns with a heat so intense Antarctica seems suddenly appealing in comparison, then fades into the embers of autumn with barely a sigh. John drives to Dubuque, takes 3 bikes on a test drive along the bluffs above the Mississippi, and the smile on his face when he's done doesn't dim one whit when he considers that it'll be another year before he can take one home. He counts the change in the coffee can that evening, lining up the quarters and nickels, bagging them in cheap Target sandwich bags, and totaling up the figures in a battered notebook that tells him how much he has squirreled away. He writes Rodney an email about the trip, includes a link to the dealer's website, and sleeps the sleep of the happily exhausted, the memory of a nickel's weight against his palm following him into dreams. Rodney uses orange post-it notes in October. He draws a pumpkin face on one, and a speech bubble that says, "I'm Kavanaugh. I don't feel the need to theorize balance in the spatial curvature of a wormhole." John snorts to imagine a 12-year-old Rodney trick-or-treating as Einstein and calling the local matrons insufferably stupid. The farm's washed pale by November frost when John gets out of bed on Veterans Day, sunlight thin and insubstantial against the grain of the floor. He can already feel the prospect of his day unraveling, and by the time he's drunk enough to call Rodney that evening, sitting on the floor, well away from the broken glass of the beer bottle he threw while he yelled obscenities meant for his father, he can feel his agitation like a trembling chaos that resonates down to the molecules at his core. Rodney's clearly taken aback by the call, but in 30 seconds has apparently decided to take it all in his stride. Babbles about colleagues and the masterful strides he's made in theoretics of negative energy string loops, until John has a hold of himself and can poke back, pointing out that theory's just imagination, and Rodney's creating possibility out of nothing, just like a novelist. Rodney splutters, heaps insult upon the Cubs, the Patriots, and John's ability to father children, then asks what happened, listens while John haltingly tries to explain about his dad in Afghanistan, interrupting only to express long-winded derision for men with more medals than brains. "You should eat a banana," Rodney says at last. "Banana?" "Potassium. Something to do with the... Oh, for heaven's sake, it's not like medicine's an actual science. Why the hell would I have the remotest idea why it works? But trial and error have instilled in me a healthy respect for the miraculous powers of the banana to ward off hangovers of the type you're currently coaxing into existence." "Banana. And you should drink a very large glass of water and take 2 painkillers before bed." "Okay." For Christmas, John MapQuests every batting cage in the greater Berkeley area, sends the printout to Rodney, and includes a roll of quarters and a brand new bat. Rodney sends him a Leafs jersey with "Pain in the Ass" printed as his name, right above the number 11, Rodney's favorite number of dimensions in space. When Rodney calls on December 26th, it's John's turn to fill in the silence, to recount the accident with the turkey, the parakeet, and the golden retriever at the Mahaligans' house on Christmas Eve, to describe the way the farm looks beneath a blanket of fresh-fallen snow, and to not ask what's wrong, since he already knows how it feels to ache with a loneliness that creeps up without warning when you're least equipped to deal with it. John sees the concert advertised just after New Year's, and buys a plane ticket for Rodney 4 days later. He wants to believe McKay won't ask questions, just accept the gift out of some unexplored spirit of altruism, but he knows he's out of his mind to imagine that's possible. Trouble is, he's not sure what to say when Rodney asks what he's thinking, so instead of trying to figure out an answer, he waits 3 weeks to send the ticket. Or 37 back-and-forth emails and the ongoing debate of Rodney McKay, smarter than Sir Isaac Newton? He's done his homework. The concert's on the Saturday of the last weekend of Berkeley spring break. He picks a flight from SFO to Cedar Rapids that should get in around 6 p.m. Plenty of room to maneuver if there are storms at O'Hare or delays on the coast. He mails it off and waits. 3 days later, the phone rings in accusation. Hello? You sent me a plane ticket to Iowa. John screws up his face for a second. Yes? Why did you send me a plane ticket to Iowa? There's a concert. In Iowa. Yeah. You know, I happen to live in a major metropolitan area. We have theaters, opera, the symphony, art galleries, museums, and, I might add, a very talented young man with bright blue hair who likes to hang out by the student union and juggle gourds. We have strip shows, movie theaters, bathhouses, excellent Chinese food, a tram I can travel if I'm really at loose end, and there's nothing on any of the 600 cable channels for which I pay an obscene amount of money, considering I am never home. Why would I fly to Iowa to see a concert? Rodney, oh please, don't use the whine. I'm not whining. You're whining. You're a grown man and a product of the U.S. military system, and yet, faced with a question you can't answer, you whine. Were you aware that I can tell when you're pouting through email? If there were lessons on stealth and subtlety at the Air Force Academy... I didn't go to the Air Force Academy. Well, that's probably why your stealth skills are pitiful, wouldn't you say? John scuffed his boot on the floor. I checked. It's your spring break. And you assume I have nothing better to do than fly to the middle of Praise the Lord, it's Corn for Dinnerville, and see the local yokels whack spoons against their knees? Snob. Yes. Yes, I am. He paused. A concert. Yeah. Another pause. I suppose you have spent quite a lot of money, Rodney says, as if the words are physically painful. And there'll be the $100 penalty for changing the ticket, which is just a scam in proof the airlines are run by small dictatorships based in offshore locales, living on highly alcoholic drinks with small umbrellas in the glass while I subsidize their guava habit with the inadequate recompense I receive for consistently challenging contemporary understanding of scientific possibility. John blinks. Sure. Did anyone put up a cell phone tower yet? Not that I noticed. Barbaric. So? So? Will you come? A deep, heartfelt sigh. Clearly I need to take up the portion of my benefits package that attends to mental health, because yes. Yes, I'll come. Awesome. What are you, 12? Thereabouts. John grins. Rodney spends the next 2 months trying to wheedle the great high secret about the concert out of John, a pastime John quickly grasps is all about winding him up within an inch of his life, rather than any real desire to know. A man who can allegedly hack into air traffic control systems of enough major airports to make the nation's planes spell out, "I love Journey," with their flight paths, can surely look at a website to work out what might be playing in Iowa City in March. Despite the obvious joy it gives Rodney to try and wheedle and plead for information, he's easily distracted. John dangles one well-placed comment about the first Star Trek movie in an email, and Rodney's off and running, offering chapter and verse on why it's ludicrous to suggest, a la the movie Armageddon, that the Russian space station mirror could generate artificial gravity by rotation and yet not split apart like a tasty donut. At which point, John suggests Rodney go get some breakfast. From there, it's a short hop, skip, and a jump to considering which fictional technology they'd like to get their hands on. Rodney wants a Death Star. John wants a lightsaber. The closer March comes, the more absurd the conversations become, and John's not so dense as to miss the fact that nerves are at play. 2 days before the flight to Iowa, Rodney has a mid-level panic attack about packing the right clothing for the season, and confesses to calling Iowa State climatologist for advice. "We have stores, you know," John drawls. "Even a mall. You could shop for whatever you don't have. And make my selection from racks of plaid polyester and overalls, no doubt," Rodney sniffs. John meets Rodney from the plane with a double pack of Twinkies in his pocket, and Rodney's look of snack cake adoration is worth every bit of needling that's colored the last 2 months. John's nerves don't come back until they're sitting in Hunter Auditorium waiting for the concert to begin. He fiddles with his program, taps his foot against the richly carpeted floor, manages, by some Herculean effort, not to start gnawing on his fingernails. But it's a close-run thing. Suddenly, he's struck how ludicrous this is. He's lured a semi-domesticated McKay out from his natural environment, a lab, fitted with at least 2 top-of-the-line coffee pots and a cupboard devoted to chocolate, to sit in a tiny concert hall among very nice Iowans who have no idea how easily their evening could be ruined by Rodney's huffs of derision. "Would you stop fidgeting?" Rodney asks. "Would you read your damn program?" John shoots back, wanting some indication of whether he's completely or only moderately insane to have cooked up this whole trip. "Oh, no," Rodney smiles at him, mouth a thin, smug line. "You went to all this trouble to keep your secret? Wouldn't want to spoil it." John sets his jaw. "It's hardly spoiling it now that we're here, is it?" "I have been in your company for," Rodney checks his watch, 24 hours and 50 minutes, give or take a few seconds. I'm not entirely sure how fast I made it off the plane and through the positively cavernous halls of the Eastern Iowa airport. But that said, I'm quite sure waiting a few more moments for your big reveal won't kill you." "No," John says, very low, "but it may cause me to kill you." "Please." Rodney looks back at the velvet curtains drawn across the stage. "Your pinky finger death threats don't impress me. With my training as an engineer, I could turn that chair into a complex guillotine in roughly 30 seconds. You'd be beheaded before you could recall which boot had a knife stuck inside it." "You are such an annoying bastard," John growls. "Forgot, did ya? Absent, heart, fonder, all that shit. You're a regular Hallmark card of joy." John hisses and is about to apologize to the lady beside him for making her flinch when the sounds of a string quartet tuning their instruments filter into the hall. Moments later, the lights dim and the curtain rises. For the next hour and a half, Rodney does nothing but gape. The complex music of sun rings flows over and around them, the rise and fall of notes coaxed from strings interwoven with a symphony captured from the spaces between stars. Violins play in harmony with the bird-like whistle of a solar wind, cellos with a chorus generated by electrons spiraling through Jupiter's atmosphere. Behind the members of the Kronos Quartet spill image after image of the reaches of space, starbursts, solar flares, the Earth seen from afar, and equations twist through the light and sound to splash the promise of astrophysics across the stage. John sneaks a glance at Rodney partway through the second movement and ducks his head, pleased and relieved at the look on the other man's face. The ride back to the farm is spent in drifting silence. John idly wonders if there's anyone in the world who can claim the distinction of having shut Rodney McKay up on 2 separate occasions, but doesn't ask. Rodney's squinting out of the window, looking up into the clear, cold night, having who knows what conversation with himself about the events of the evening. John's almost sorry to pull into the lane at the farm, to put the truck in park and turn off the ignition, break the spell. It's a mesmerizing night, I was showing off. Out of the truck, John pauses to look up and chart the familiar constellations he remembers from his childhood. The Big Dipper, Orion, music still echoing at the back of his mind. He turns to look at Rodney, who's rounding from the truck, wearing the strangest expression. He immediately wonders if Rodney suffers from motion sickness. Are you? Rodney pauses. He's standing a fraction too close. He shuts his mouth, apparently lost for words. John realizes, with a sickening lurch, that the silence in the truck might have been rooted in horror, not satisfaction. Music and physics. I remembered about the piano lesson, see, and I thought you'd like it. Especially when I found out about the pictures they took, and... John clamps his jaw shut, rueing this Rodney-induced Newtonian variation. For every silence, an equal and opposite reaction. Shut up, Rodney whispers, reaching to take John's head gently between his hands, leaning in to kiss him softly, lips embarrassed warmth. John gasps and pulls back, just a fraction. Hey, that's my move, he protests feebly. The hands. You want a back? My move? Yeah. Not right now. And he doesn't remember shifting, but his hands at the back of Rodney's neck, pulling him in, anticipating the kiss, and it's clumsy and awkward, but oh so fucking good. It's its own solar flare. They make it upstairs without switching on a light or exchanging much in the way of conversation. Hands moving restlessly, sliding under shirts, skimming over too warm skin, coaxing breasts to hitch and break until a bed hits the back of John's knees, and they're sprawled together, half-dressed and moving too slowly for the supernova that's threatening to explode in the pit of John's belly, in the curve of his spine, and in the pulse of his wrist. He rolls to pin Rodney to the mattress, drags his teeth across the hollow of his throat, undresses him, greedy for the sounds he makes, needy and desperate as he reaches with clumsy hands to pull at John's shirt, work at his fly. Yeah, John gasps, kicking his pants to the floor, pulling Rodney flush against him, swallowing the fractured moan that resonates between them, slick and sweaty, urgent, a blur. He slips a hand between their bodies, wraps his fingers around them both, tugs, whines, and buries his face at Rodney's throat as he works them hard and fast for completion. Later, much later, he's breathing hard, and Rodney's heart still pounding beneath his ear. There's a splash of moonlight on the floor by the window, and Rodney's hands like a brand at the small of his back. Wow, John manages. Music and physics, Rodney mumbles. I thought maybe you finally, he licks his lips, got that I'm right about baseball. Rodney snorts softly. In your dreams. He falls asleep, happy to oblige. They reach for each other again in the gray half-light of dawn, slower they'd been frantic, patient where they'd rushed heedlessly before. John falls asleep to the brush of Rodney's fingertips against his cheek. When he wakes, Rodney's gone. The note's on the kitchen table, blue marker on yellow legal paper, and John knows he owns neither. Imagines Rodney searching through his laptop case for something serviceable. He makes a cup of coffee before he reads it, swallows bitterly when he notices the change by the phone for the cab Rodney must have called. It's likely $60 or more to get to the airport from the farm, and he hopes to hell that burns. It's cold comfort, but he'll take what he can get, anything to fill the gaping pit of shame and regret that's slowly opening up inside him. The note's brief and to the point. I'm sorry, I have to go. He realizes, as he crumples the paper into a ball, that he's been falling by inches for nearly a year now. Some pilot not to have anticipated this kind of landing. He works. There are loose tiles on the barn roof from the last storm, and down the limbs in the furthest pasture beneath the big oak that need hauling away. Here and there the fence that runs by the roadside needs fixing, and the corn crib could use a new coat of paint. Mitch needs someone to fix the leak in the kitchen at the bar, and as soon as the first real warm day comes in April, Mrs. Gunderson needs someone to mow her yard, someone to clear the brush from her orchard. Joe needs help pouring new concrete floor for his garage, and cleaning up his barn now he's decided not to bother with livestock anymore. There's the broken tread in Eileen Yoder's basement stairs that needs replacing, and the plaster needs to come down at the Jackson's place. Drywall's a messy business, and for 4 straight days, it takes John half an hour to shower the dust out of his hair. If it doesn't exactly fix anything that's broken in John, it's at least a distraction. He mails Rodney's note back to California, with "you motherfucker" scrawled on the other side. He's furious at his own weakness, at how much he misses him. If he lets down his guard, thinks of that night, the slide of the bodies, the fierce warmth of Rodney's mouth, the tangled, desperate right feeling of hip against thigh, it's all he can do not to double over, crouch to force the sickening regret into the smallest space it can hold. But the ache in his bones doesn't come from the memory of skin beneath his palm. It's silence that gnaws a misery he can't seem to evade. He misses the emails, the phone calls, the letters. He misses the goddamn homework questions and the post-it notes. Misses the bickering, the disagreements, the unexpected sound of his own laughter. He misses having someone tell him to eat a godforsaken banana and hates himself for it. Kicks the tires of his long-suffering truck and throws a baseball bat into the attic. His only respite is working on the chair, forcing himself to focus on nothing but the grain of wood beneath his fingertips, the rasp of sandpaper and the sharp scent of glue. May 23rd, and John's lying on the couch. It's 10 a.m., but his motivation's taken a vacation, and he counts it as an achievement. He's dressed. Worn jeans, hole at the knee, wall imprint on the back pocket, black t-shirt. Rather than slouching around in nothing more than boxer shorts and a grimace, he's idly considering the things he could do that day. Garden needs some work. He's low on groceries. Jerry'd welcome a hand with his roof. There's glazing for the barn windows to price out. When he hears the rumble of tires on the gravel of a lane and ruefully swings himself up off the sofa. He peers through the window. A black SUV with Illinois plates is parked 20 feet from the house, and he narrows his eyes in suspicion, turns and moves to the kitchen and out onto the porch, sharp words ready for whomever's disturbing his well-earned morning of self-pity, until he sees Rodney standing in his yard. "Hi," Rodney says, flushed a searing shade of pink. John stares, jaw tight. "Probably weren't expecting to see me," Rodney continues, looking abashed. John manages to quirk an eyebrow in response, curls one hand into a fist. Rodney sees the movement, flinches, but doesn't step back. He wets his lips and shifts foot to foot. "I'm sorry about, you know, when I..." He ducks his head and mutters something to himself, looks utterly miserable and out of his depth. John waits. Rodney's head snaps up and he tilts his chin, a familiar gesture of defiance that makes John's stomach twist. "There's a position, a distinguished visiting scholar program, in Iowa City, at the university. The physics program, to be exact. A physics program I was somewhat hasty in dismissing, it turns out, and the position, the distinguished visiting scholar position, that is, it comes with lab space and 2 assistants, and whomever the person is only has to give 2 lectures per semester, which is somewhat bearable, barely, sort of." He presses his lips together for a second. "I'm the person, visiting, distinguished." John makes a small sound of derision. They have housing for me in town. An apartment, I believe. Maybe a house. I didn't pay much attention, and, he looks, John thinks, exactly as if someone is trying to pull his intestines through his navel. "Well, I'll be here. Until next August." "Huh." John grinds his teeth for a second. "Well, you have fun." He turns to go back into the house. "Wait! Excuse me?" And his anger's there, simmering just beneath the surface of his words, violent, hurt, sharp as a blade. Rodney gestures helplessly. "You came out here to tell me I should watch my step around town, to give me the courtesy of knowing you'd be in my fucking neck of the woods? I get it," John spits. Rodney pales. No! He takes a step forward, then wavers, perhaps reconsidering. They didn't ask me. I asked them. What? John shakes his head. I asked them. Well, begged them, actually, would be more precise. I didn't actually get down on my knees. It was all over the phone, you understand. So it wouldn't have helped even if I had. But I offered, and I offered again, and I think there was some concern that I wouldn't be contented with the remuneration. But the money's not remotely important, and there was only the question of whether I would make the undergraduates cry. But really, if they can't handle a little criticism, they have no business going into this field, and... He swallows. I asked them. Why? Because of you.
Me?
Yeah. You're dabbling in the psychotropic drugs now, are you, McKay?
What?
No. Then explain to me how the fuck you walk out after... He gestures. What happened? And don't so much as fucking apologize. Never mind, explain yourself, and then clam up like the whole business has a security clearance I'm not privy to for 2 fucking months. Rodney starts wringing his hands. He grits his teeth. Was terrified.
Of what?
You. This. I woke up, and you were fast a-fucking asleep beside me, and you don't get that? That's terrifying.
Nice, McKay.
I mean it in a good way.
A good way.
Yes, good way. Like, look at you. Look at you and look at me. How on earth could that possibly...
John gapes.
You are fucked up.
I know. That's exactly my point. And I panicked. I saw you lying there asleep and you were smiling and I panicked. I'm still panicking.
So you ran off?
Yes.
And has that worked for you in any fucking relationship since you were 13?
John asks, incredulous.
Rodney looks utterly broken.
Well, there haven't been that many.
John lets out a breath, his anger leaching away despite his determination to stay mad. His fingers uncurl, and if his gut's still twisting, it's for a whole different reason than before. He steps down from the porch.
You're a piece of work, he growls.
Yes. He crosses the space between them.
And that was a fucking shitty thing to do.
Yes.
That said...
Rodney looks up.
God damn you, Rodney,
John grits out, setting his jaw, giving in. He reaches out, cups Rodney's face with both hands, and leans in to kiss him. Rodney flinches and pulls back a fraction.
Your move, he whispers.
Yeah. Mind if I have it back?
Not right now, no.
And Rodney leans in to meet him, hand curling around John's arm, and John can feel the tremor in his fingertips. Come September, John catches a ride to Dubuque with Mitch, writes the largest check of his life, and heads home on a Triumph Rocket 3 Classic that's entirely his. He takes the back roads, less traffic, fewer cops, and speeds until he's breathless with it, joy backed up in his lungs, exhilaration singing through his veins as he leans into each corner. Feels the tug of the wind, each bump of the road. It feels like flying, the instinctive way he guides the bike, the soaring freedom conjured by his hands. When he slows to pull into the lane by the farm, he feels washed out, clean, hewn from new cloth. Rodney's working at the kitchen table when John steps inside, turns his head to meet John's kiss without ever really looking away from his laptop screen. John grins, setting down his helmet, watches Rodney drink his 7th cup of coffee that day, and tap out equations with focused impatience. This feels like flying, too. And Then There Was Finn, by Shia Frotherdon, rated R, read by Hack Benjamin 22. They have 7 days before Rodney's due back in Berkeley, a short trip home to pack what he can, store what he can't, and see his life loaded into garish trucks.
They're always garish. Are you kidding me? Eyesores of the first water? It's as if they're poking fun at people already blighted, forced to uproot.
What?
What? Don't look at me like that. Grapes of wrath touched me, okay?
They spend their first full day together on some kind of roller coaster, touching each other as if to prove they can. Kissing sloppily, propped up against door jams in front of the fridge with the door wide open, tumbled on the couch. Between times there are awkward moments, cautious glances, and halting conversation, until Rodney snarls, "Fuck it," and drags John to bed, mousing apologies to the inside of his thigh, pressing demands against his stomach, his hip. Afterwards, his words new and clumsy, John rolls them both over, kisses Rodney quiet. "We're starting over," he manages, and hears Rodney huff, "Duh," before he falls asleep. They drive into town the next morning. John falls in love with the house the physics folk have rented for Rodney, a three-bedroom standalone with hardwood floors, a shaded garden, and a wraparound porch. There's parking off the street and the house, and a move that suggests Rodney's reputation more than precedes him. It's 2 solid miles from where most students live. There's the lawn service, leaf service, and snow service for the asking. And if Rodney experiences a wholesale shift in personality, he can walk from the house to his lab. Rodney seems to like the town, as much as it clearly pains him to admit it. The creeping panic that had him babbling in the track about earthquakes and fog and barefoot hippies begins to recede once John shows him the specialty grocery store with bins of coffee standing 6 feet high. Rodney strives for acclimation in his own way, insists they spend the rest of the day sampling every form of noodle that can be found within 10 minutes of the physics building, and devises an intricate point system to rate the merits of Thai over Chinese over generic Italian. They find a cafe that serves all-day cereal at 4 in the afternoon, and Rodney almost breaks down and weeps right there on the sidewalk, gesturing helplessly. He's so moved by the perfection of the idea. The move's a big adjustment, a sudden burst of momentum where they'd been used to creeping, and John's not surprised to wake 3 nights later to find an empty space where Rodney should be sleeping. He pads downstairs, following the smell of coffee that's not going to help Rodney's sleeplessness any, finds him sitting at the kitchen table, yellow notepaper and blue pen in hand. John's not over fond of the combination. The memory of Rodney's, "I have to go," is still too fresh. But Rodney pushes the notepad toward him, and John finds himself looking at a list. Town. Convenient location. Could work late. Big house. Room for cat. Liquor stores. Good beer. Bookstore. Passable selection. Availability of late-night burritos. All major national newspapers available in the morning. Farm. Nature. Food grows in dirt. Deer fling themselves at cars. 45-minute drive from lab, in good weather, may get snowed in, the quiet. It doesn't seem a very promising list. John can replace town with pros and farm with cons and get a sense of what's going on here, save for the last item on the farm side. John, written in bold ink and underlined several times. He smiles just a little, weirdly touched, and glances at Rodney, who's pale and tired-looking in his prime-number boxer shorts, screwing up his mouth as if he's going to say something difficult. "I thought perhaps," Rodney says, tilting his chin, "I might live here, most of the time, except for those evenings where I really can't get in a car and I have this habit, see, of getting engrossed in things and forgetting to eat or sleep or look at a clock, and it'll be some ridiculous time of the night, like 3 a.m., which is the most ridiculous time of the night, I'm fairly sure I have mathematical proof of that, and I'll look up and think, 'Oh God, I can't drive. I'll crash into one of those maniacally suicidal deer that like to hang out by the side of the road just waiting for unsuspecting California drivers to try and get by without death or injury,' and then I'll probably just," he sighs. "Well, let's face it. I'll probably fall asleep at my desk, drooling on my notes, because that's been the case before, and I bet I could have cracked the problem of the mass gap in the Yang-Mills theory if I hadn't completely obliterated those equations with saliva. But perhaps, on those nights, I might go back to the house and sleep. A little." He takes a breath and looks at his own knees. "Otherwise, I thought I might live here. If that was okay." John slides a hand to the back of Rodney's neck and leans to kiss his forehead. "Is that a yes?" Rodney asks, sounding worried. "Of course it's a yes," John mumbles, voice thick with sleep as he sets the notebook down.
Come on. Bed. I made coffee. I was just going to... Bed, says John, and Randy's mouth makes a perfect little O. Well, I have had trouble sleeping, he says hopefully, standing and awkwardly scratching the round of his belly. Mm-hmm. John switches off the light. And I sleep particularly well after. Rodney? Yes? Shut up and get upstairs. Oh, right. One blowjob later. Oh, God, John. John. Rodney falls asleep, an arm thrown haphazardly over John's chest, knee bent in a fashion that'll be murder in the morning, mouth open, snoring softly. John watches him, thinks of the vegetables growing in the dark, rich soil outside, and the December quiet of a second snowfall. He smiles and tugs the blanket a little higher. He never thought blissed out would look like this. Next morning, he's up before Rodney and stands in the living room, mentally shuffling furniture around. After two cups of coffee and much deliberation, he moves the bureau to the basement, along with one of the chairs, takes a couple of pictures off the wall, and shoves half his DVD collection in a barely used drawer. He pours another mug of coffee and wanders to the barn, sorts through the wood that's stacked against one wall, and sketches out a plan on the lumberyard receipt. By the time Rodney finds him, he's almost finished. There's a blood blister livid beneath the thumbnail on his left hand, and the muscles in his shoulders are stiff and sore, but he's content, happy. Feels accomplished. Rodney just looks appalled. What are you doing? He asks, clutching at a mug of coffee like it's a life preserver, as though the grass and bindweed might conceal an undertow. John pounds in one last nail and stands back to eye his work, setting his hammer on the tool bench. Bookcase, he says, gesturing. I can see that. Why are you building a bookcase? John runs a hand over the length of one shelf. Figured you'd need space for your stuff. That's... Rodney gestures over his shoulder. The mysterious holes in the living room, the cabinet, and the... He stares as though confronted by an elder bug twice his size. You're making room for me? John hitches a shoulder. Sure, why not? Rodney lifts his chin. I'm not easy to live with. He says as if offering up state secrets under duress. I'm shocked, John deadpans. I get very territorial about things like toilet paper. So we'll buy extra. And I'm very particular about my Jell-O. Your Jell-O? Yes, blue, always. If not blue, I can deal with red, but I'll probably whine and you'll want to hit me. People have. Hit you? Wanted to. John nods sagely. I can barely imagine. I like to store half-eaten bags of chips down the back of the sofa cushions for ease of snacking on future occasions. I find it streamlines the experience of true couch potato-ness. John squints. Pretty sure that's not a word. You're absolutely missing the point. Rodney? John slips his hands into the pockets of his jeans, thumbs hooked over the pockets. Not sure if you noticed yet. But I'm a guy. I could hardly have missed it, considering the uses you've found for your... So I'm just saying... John continues with exaggerated patience, stepping closer. I understand the virtue of a half-hidden bag of Doritos, all right? And I drop towels on the bathroom floor and regularly shove my dirty boxers under the bed. Rodney colors. Oh. Yeah. Oh. John crosses the barn. Would you calm the fuck down? Unlikely, Rodney manages, but leans forward, lets his forehead thud against John's shoulder. All right, then, John murmurs. He pauses for effect. Want to help me carry a bookcase inside? Only weighs, like, 45 pounds. I don't do manual labor, Rodney mumbles. You're the rough trade in this relationship. John snorts and bites the skin just below Rodney's ear. Wuss, he whispers and turns back to the bookcase, lifting it easily and waiting with a smile. Think you can get the door? He asks, with mock concern. Asshole. But the corner of Rodney's mouth almost twitches, and John feels a grin on his own face before he can give it a thought. Rodney leaves for California at the end of the week, and John's left with a sudden awareness of empty space and drifting silence, where there once wasn't absence at all. It freaks him out a little, to have cleared out space in his head as well as his living room, and he spends a couple of days purposefully parking the truck so there's no room for another car in front of the garage, and sleeping in the middle of the bed, just to prove a point. "Do you have the original Star Wars trilogy?" Rodney asks on the phone one evening. If the random thumps John can hear over the line are anything to go by, he's packing while he talks. "Course," John says. "Huh." The thumping noises. John has a vision of DVDs being thrown into a box. "Stop. So, maybe I should put mine in storage." John swallows. "Okay, this is serious. This is a man's sci-fi collection they're talking about. Somehow, they've moved from email buddies, who fuck after concerts, and break up before they've begun anything, to this, men with a double set of DVDs, and fuck, he's this guy?" He sets his jaw. "Well, on the other hand, maybe I should bring them. There's always the other house. What if I go back there at 4 a.m. and I'm struck by the need to contemplate the battle readiness of the X-Wing over the Y-Wing fighter?" "It's happened," Rodney says wistfully. "Yeah, other house. Yeah, or perhaps I'm in the mood for Empire and you're in the mood for Jedi and..." John frowns, baffled. "Who picks Jedi over Empire?"
"You might have some sort of... urge."
"Urge? To watch, I don't know, small furry animals vanquish other species much larger than themselves, and arguably more technologically advanced." "I want that. I can go spy on the goddamn rabbits in the radishes," John drawls. Rodney sighs. John can almost picture the look of concentrated patience on his face. "Do we need 2 copies? He asks. John swallows. "I really don't know," he manages. "We're pathetic," Rodney offers. "Yeah," John agrees. "It's a DVD.
"Yeah."
A pause. "Are your hands sweating too?" Rodney sounds vaguely strangled. "I haven't been this damn lightheaded since the last time I swallowed helium at Brad's birthday party," John confesses. There's a choking noise on the other end of the line, and after a split second of panic, John realizes Rodney's laughing. "We lose," Rodney manages. "We're having an existential crisis over a digitally recorded tale of ambiguous outlaws and renegades up against the man." John half smiles. "Fuck you." He pulls a beer out of the fridge. "Make sure you pack your goddamn baseball bat." It's easier when they're together, when Rodney comes back with 2 suitcases of journals and a selection of shirts in dubious shades of brown, when the truck shows up in Iowa City and Rodney stops just short of an apoplectic fit over the way the movers manhandle his filing cabinets, when, with 8 enormous boxes piled haphazardly in the bed of the truck, they stop at the grocery store on the way back to the farm and reach for pepperoni frozen pizza at the same time. The bookcase, stained and polyurethaned in Rodney's absence, fills with books, and John doesn't say a word when Rodney thumbtacks his poster of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy to the inside of the bedroom door. They argue about the best way to file Rodney's bootleg copies of Doctor Who, by order of doctoral incarnation, Rodney's preference, or by who was the coolest, John's. John draws the line at a lime-green lava lamp that Rodney admits came from an ex-girlfriend, who was overly fond of rats. Her laboratory rats. "What are you? You think I date people who comb dumpsters for affection?"
"Do you?"
"I'm not dignifying that with an answer."
"Clearly that means yes."
"You are so sleeping in the wet patch tonight." But finds an empty ice cream carton in which Rodney can store his peanut butter cups so the mice don't get them.
if mice should show. They make little adjustments. John stops buying orange juice, and Ronnie starts drinking his coffee without cream, and touch by touch they learn just where to press and stroke and nip to make the other one fall apart. They learn to take their time, to forget the urgency of separate time zones, to kiss and tease wrapped around one another, moving slowly until they're quaking with something that almost hurts. When John finally presses inside Rodney's body, it's August, humid, and with his lips against the curve of Rodney's spine, John swears, the whole damn world's gonna come apart, can't hold together, not after this. Rodney goes back to Berkeley again in September. There's a department meeting he can't miss if he has any hope of browbeating his colleagues into supporting the regional super collider rather than fund for new potted plants, wall art, and carpet in the lounge. And there are grad students to terrify, 4 prelim exams to administer, and meetings with 2 deans and the VP of research to suffer through in painful silence. John comes back from helping Arnold Miller lay a new deck out the back of his ranch house to find Rodney's deluged his inbox with piercing insights into the workings of his day. Time, 9:18 a.m. Subject, kill me now. If Jenkins doesn't shut up about the earth-shattering implications of fully appreciating his research into the fluffy bunny, ill-defined, useless, brainless machinations of universal entropy, I will fashion a hollow-tipped spear from the pencil in my hand and launch it directly at his heart. Time, 10:01 a.m. Subject, no really. The only forms of life who should be as interested in questions of carpeting as some of my colleagues seem to be are carpet-eating bacteria hidden in some remote pocket of the universe who lack the higher brain function to understand what carpet is. Every second I sit here, another neuron dies. Time, 10:42 a.m. Subject, addendum. Also, you're wrong. Tom Baker was way cooler than William Hartnell. Idiot. Time, 11:12 a.m. Subject, aha. I finally understand. This is all an elaborate experiment to gauge the efficiency of stupidity as a weapon. I think I may be bleeding from my eyes. John grins and writes back the details of his epic battle with the squirrels over the Miller's place, itemizes the 7 splinters he earned, and the events that caused them to get buried in his palm, his forearm, and his thigh, and sketches out the bike ride he's planning to take the next day, since he refuses to spend another afternoon hammering planks to framing when it's 75 degrees and the sky is a careless, yawning blue. Hope you're not actually bleeding from your eyes, buddy. Pretty sure that'd make it hard to operate a super collider, no matter how damn smart you are. Twinkies were on sale at the gas station. I bought you 4 boxes, and a lighter that says World's Best Ioan. That way, if you get stuck in another meeting next time you have to go back, you can set everyone on fire with more than your mind. Rodney flies in a week later, still vaguely dazed and gibbering about the boundaries of science versus high-loop carpet weave, when John fetches him from the airport. So then, as if he hadn't already proven his monumental stupidity by claiming to have read Johnson's theorem on... Rodney pauses as they reach the truck, turns his head to look out over the fields that stretch in every direction, at the sun low in the sky that's almost the same color as ripening corn. Wow, I... He looks at John over the hood of the truck, expression somewhere between stricken and elated. I'm home. John feels some strange, warm pressure build in his chest, and ducks his head, looks toward the sunset himself. Yeah, he nods, and opens the door, climbs in the cab and turns the ignition while his lungs and stomach work out their proper places in his body again. I may have to hyperventilate, Randy says, climbing into the passenger seat, looking pale. Go right ahead, John offers placidly, and puts the truck in reverse. He's about to back out of the parking space when he realizes he can't, slams on the brake and reaches to wrap his right hand around the back of Rodney's neck, pulling him in to roughly kiss his temple. All right. he says, letting go, looking over his shoulder out the cab window and trying to ignore Rodney's look of surprise. You... John swallows and nods toward the booths where the parking attendants sit. Got a dollar? Yeah, Rodney murmurs, and when John glances in his direction, he's smiling, as if he's just worked out some puzzle or another. Yeah, I do. Rodney works, and once or twice a week doesn't come back to the farm, showing up the next night creased and stale with ink marks on his face where he fell asleep on top of his pen. John gets used to the Rodney McKay early warning system, learns that when Rodney twitches in his sleep, he's likely moments after to sit bolt upright in bed, eyes alight with some feverish new understanding, before scrambling out from beneath the covers and hurrying away to find his laptop. The laptop itself's a marker, a signal, and John accepts that when the computer's on, he barely exists in Rodney's world. There are other compensations, so he doesn't mind. Like Rodney's feeling toward his work boots and tools.
You weren't kidding about me being your bit of rough, were you?
John asks, startled. The night he comes home from roofing the Giddens' place, pinned against the kitchen door, he's still clutching the insulated coffee mug he took to work that morning. Rodney leans in to suck on his neck. Not remotely, he pants, and his fingers are quick and busy at John's fly. John thinks it over with what brain cells aren't burning away at Rodney's touch. I could wear the boots more often. Okay, Rodney mumbles breathlessly as he falls to his knees. It gets to be a habit that they head down to Mitch's bar either Friday or Saturday night, sometimes both, and by October, Rodney's finally stopped sitting with his back against the wall, glancing at the rest of the regulars out of the corner of his eye. Whether by innate talent, an appreciation for the geometry of the game, or blind luck, he proves a prodigy at pool, and twice wipes the floor with Brad, pocketing a penknife, a piece of chalk, 2 half-eaten packets of gum, 4 unused condoms, and just over $50 in cash. It's October 11th when the whole bar learns that after 6 beers, Dr. Rodney McKay, Ph.D., can be reliably trusted to break out into song, and after 7, climb onto the bar and impersonate Sean Connery with uncanny precision. It's October 12th by the time John finally manages to pry Rodney away from the jukebox and take him home, laughing as he tumbles him into bed and strips off his clothes. Rodney helpfully accompanies the whole procedure with a slurred rendition of Crazy by Patsy Cline, and kisses John on the ear before falling into a sudden abandoned sleep, sprawled diagonally across the bed. A week later, Rodney's sick as a dog, with plague. It has to be plague, bubonic plague most likely. And things get abnormally quiet while he sleeps off his cold. Come November, John decides the clan should descend on his place for Thanksgiving, and Rodney approaches the idea as if the meal is his prey and he's the predator who must make an efficient kill. He wanders off at the grocery store, eschewing the frozen food aisle, turning up later with a can of mushroom soup in his hand, reading the instructions for green bean casserole with a singular intensity. John explains the concept of potluck again, but Rodney looks so crestfallen that John sets the can of soup into the cart and suggests they go find French onion rings and a disposable baking pan. In the end, the holiday's memorable not for the fact that Brad brings a keg as his contribution, or that Mitch thinks Cheez-Its are a side dish, but for the conversation Rodney tries to have with his sister that night, holed up in the bedroom, awkwardly trying to reach across the distance in protective indifference to patch together his family again. Rodney flies to California the following Monday, chasing the tail end of November toward warmer climes. There are 2 grad students' dissertations in his carry-on, inked in vicious red pen, and 2 defenses scheduled for the next 10 days. John sees him off, raises his hand in a haphazard wave as Rodney looks back just before the security checkpoint, hoards the sight of his crooked smile, watches as Rodney sets his laptop on the belt, his bag behind it, and steps through the scanners into a different world. They talk that night, briefly, barely, but the next evening Rodney calls unnaturally early, and John can all but reach out and touch the desperation that's alive and dangerous on the line. Rodney?
What happened?
He's tensed, poised for action, and has to consciously order his muscles to relax.
Did I ever mention Katie?
John frowns.
Katie who?
Katie Brown, who, I might have, before you and I were a thing that night, that thing, before that, I might have been sort of, perhaps involved with her.
You were dating someone?
John asks, surprised.
No, not dating. It was a mutually beneficial arrangement where we both had sex without either of us having to invest time in a relationship and divert precious energy and resources away from our work.
Wow, you're a freak.
She's a botanist.
Well, that just explains everything.
Oh, God.
John wets his lips.
How about you sit down and take a breath? I can hear your blood pressure rocketing 2 time zones away.
I'd love to. Really, I would, but this situation, it's impossible. I can't.
Oh, God.
Head between your knees, buddy.
Ronnie's voice is muffled.
Okay. John fights against the creeping sense of panic.
How about you tell me what's going on?
Ronnie makes a small primal sound that sounds a lot to John like someone dying.
Rodney?
She's pregnant, Rodney whispers.
Oh?
John tilts his head, confused.
Well, that's nice.
No, it's not. She was going to, and then she decided she couldn't. She wasn't cut out for it. She has incredible work to do, and she's not happy, not at all, no. Not happy. She yelled a lot, and then I yelled, because I didn't know. What could I possibly do when I didn't know? It's Iowa. It's not the end of the earth. She could have called. She could have emailed. She could have camped outside my office door when I came back the last time, or the time before that, and, John squints at the flyer on the fridge that itemizes the Hawkeye football games that season.
I'm not following.
Ronnie makes the dying noise again.
She's not newly pregnant. She's 39 weeks or something.
She's huge.
John winces.
I don't think you're supposed to say that kind of thing about pregnant women.
It's mine.
It's... John has no recollection of ordering his limbs to move, but suddenly he's sitting on the kitchen floor.
Jesus.
Yes, exactly. I evoke deities, entirely appropriate. Begging, pleading, bribery, whatever you can muster.
John's mind runs madly in 17 different directions at once.
So you're calling to, tell you?
Right. And you're, gonna stay out there?
He sets his jaw against the poisonous twist in his stomach.
Well, I can hardly do anything else. I mean...
Right.
Right what?
Well, right. You should do the right thing by her, and I'll just...
You'll just what?
Rennie's voice vibrates at an impressive pitch.
Well, I know this is pretty difficult for you, so, you know, I won't make a fuss. I mean, I can ship your stuff back and...
John grimaces, empty, hollowed out in an instant.
My stuff?
There's a pained gasp on the other end of the line.
Oh, God! You're breaking up with me! Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God!
John tries to clear a path through the fog of his thoughts.
I'm what? I can't blame you.
Rennie sounds heartbroken.
I can't blame you. If the positions were reversed, I don't know that I could...
Rodney? John bangs his head against the fridge.
Slow down. Start over.
I'm not breaking up with you. You're breaking up with me.
I am not.
California.
I meant I'm... The baby's due any day. She doesn't want the kid. Of course I have to stay here until the baby's born.
The yelling penetrates the haze of confusion clouding John's brain.
She doesn't want the kid, and you...
You want the kid, and...
Yes, sort of. Well, not really. Can you imagine me with a child? The horrors I'll inflict? The bodily fluids I'll have to grow comfortable with? It seems likely it'll be a venture into utter catastrophe, and I should probably start a college fund and one for therapy right away, but I'm not. I couldn't just... No, I get it. John rubs at his forehead, trying to push away the nightmarish headache building behind his eyes. Are you saying you want to come back here? With a kid? I can go to the house in Iowa City. I understand if you... Are you fucking insane? Well, I... Rodney sounds as if he's considering the idea. I think after today, quite possibly. You'll... John looks around the kitchen, as if the spatulas and steak knives might have some advice. You'll come home, and we'll... We'll work this out. We'll figure something. We will? Yeah. John wishes he sounded more sure, because he's sure. He's sure without having the faintest clue why he's sure, and that should scare the shit out of him, but it doesn't, and that's fucking terrifying. Okay. Okay. Rodney's breathing hard. So, yeah. He nods as if that can help, and Rodney can't see him. There's a poignant silence on the other end of the line. John? Yeah? I'm gonna be a dad. Yeah. And this is when he says what a great dad Rodney'll be, but the words are lodged somewhere in his throat, which seems to be closing, locking out air. Yeah. Yeah, you're smart. Yeah. John lets out a long breath. Fuck. A huff of rueful laughter. You have no idea. A long, fragile silence. I don't mean to be, you know, or presume that you... But I wish you were here. John tenses, ready to start packing if that's what he should do. And he'd love to know what he should do, because sitting on the kitchen floor and banging his head against the fridge doesn't seem like a long-term plan. Should I come out there? No. Who knows how complicated it could get, and Rodney swallows audibly. I just miss you. Yeah. John lies back against the kitchen floor, feeling the truth of it deep in his belly. I miss you too. And he stares at the ceiling and listens to Rodney's breathing start to slow. Lost for words, but as close to him as he can get. John doesn't sleep. He knows what he's doing to a point. One, get Rodney through this. Two, bring him home. But then everything dissolves into a messy puddle of frantic indecision, and the only thing he's marginally sure of is that he doesn't know what he's doing with his own life. Never mind about some kids. Things get even messier when he hits that wall. He's selfish. He admits it. And he wants Rodney to himself, resents this interruption into something that was headed someplace good. From there, it's barely half a breath before he's knee-deep in anger, yelling at a Rodney who's only present in shadows, pointing out a condom's hardly a revolutionary idea, that someone so fucking smart should surely be able to figure out the prophylactics. He's exhausted by the time he's done, by the time he's kicked the wall, and pointed out to whomever's listening that he did not goddamn fucking sign up for this. By the time he slid down the wall to sit in a heap and stare at the covers on their undisturbed bed. Sometime before dawn, he picks himself up, shuffles downstairs, and sets a pot of coffee brewing. He pads to the basement, to a set of shelves filled with mementos he couldn't throw away, but didn't want to see, and pulls a set of photo albums from a cobweb sleep. Back in the kitchen, he sits down at the table, coffee mug in hand, and swears softly, but viciously, before he cracks open the past. He remembers parts of the childhood captured here, tucked between pages of photos from the county fair and the animal church fete. His own face grins out from the branches of the apple tree that died in 79, from the porch swing where his grandma shelled peas, from beneath the kitchen table where the canning circle made swift work of plum jam. The workroom where his grandpa made table after cupboard after chair stands immortalized in a dog-eared print, and he spies his own feet up in the rafters, his grandpa painting a bookcase below, the sepia color of all his best memories. But the parts of himself he shut away are here, too. His mom's ready smile,
the snap of her dish towel as she chased him from the kitchen, their two heads bent together over a book about flight, and his father, disdainful, barely tolerating the indignity of being captured in a snapshot, his back ramrod straight and resentment in his eyes. John touches a picture of his father, but not the outline of his father himself. He snaps the album closed and picks up his coffee, drinks it quickly, and climbs back upstairs to find jeans and a shirt. By the time dawns a glimmer on the eastern horizon, he's tugged on a jacket and headed to the barn, pulling out the rocking chair that's been standing in a corner. "So, you're thing number three," he murmurs, and sets down his mug, turns to the shelves full of half-used paint cans, and searches for the color of his grandfather's belief. There's no time to talk about the things they should be talking about. Rodney's acting on blind faith, denial, talking to lawyers and controlling what he can, and while it's clear both of them are reeling, stunned, they seem to have reached an unspoken agreement that all conversation about what this means should be postponed until one or the other of them has slept or is sane. Not that Rodney seems likely to turn sane anytime soon. Rodney, no. It's 1 p.m, and John slouched at the kitchen table, staring at a world made blurry by exhaustion. "It's easy enough. The software's already installed on my computer, the webcam's in place. It's merely a question of creating a link to whatever high-speed network's the easiest. I'm sure the hospital has a hackable system. And given a few minutes, I can set everything up so that you can see what..." "Rodney?" John clears his throat. "Not that I don't want to be part of this experience, but I kind of like to be introduced to a woman before I see her vagina." "I asked Katie. She said it would be fine, nothing underhand." "Well, it's nice that she's consented. I'm saying I don't consent. But it's a little weird. It's one of life's most natural and beautiful processes." John squints as though pained. "Did someone give you a brochure?" Rodney makes a small, derisive sound. "The nurse practitioner may have provided me with some information earlier this morning, yes?" "Well, I'm thrilled you get to experience the miracle of birth, buddy, but I don't think this is a team sport." Rodney pauses for a moment. "I'd rather not have to do this on my own." John raises an eyebrow, jamming the phone between his shoulder and his ear, slouching further against the table. "I kinda think she's the one doing this on her own." "Yes, yes, of course. It's just that if I knew you were seeing it too, I'd feel..." "What? Better?" John sighs. "That? Right there. That's emotional blackmail. Is it working?" "Rodney... is that a yes?" In the end, John's thankful for the link. There are 4 hours between the call to say Katie's in labor and Rodney hacking into the hospital's network, and by then, John's so frustrated by the great yawning distance emanating from California that he's ready to do something drastic, like drive to goddamn Berkeley or start watching infomercials for Proactive. Anything to distract him from the fact that his life's changing on a dime, and he knows how to clean and reassemble a gun, but not how to change a diaper. And that doesn't seem like a promising sort of start for a sort of possible, maybe if he wants to be a pseudo-dad. He sighs with relief when he sees the link flicker to life on his computer, even if, for several moments, he's treated to a horrifying close-up of Rodney's nasal hair, and the shot's at an angle like some crazy independent film. But he waves back when Rodney waves into the camera before realizing the video feed only runs one way. Rodney gestures with his cell phone, and John runs to the kitchen, snatches up the landline the moment it rings. "Okay, can you see things?" "Well, not right now. I'm in the kitchen." "Yes, yes, I mean in general. Did the link work?" "Yeah, and man, I am getting you nose clippers for Christmas." "What? Oh, did you? Oh, unfortunate. Look, this is nice and all, but your link works, and you should probably get back to the room with the nice lady who's pushing your air into this world. And I should get back to pacing a hole in the rugs and..." "Okay, yes, plan. I like plans." Rodney sounds stunned.
Okay, so I'll talk to you
after.
After.
Okay.
I love you.
And the line goes dead.
Rodney's little bombshell gives John plenty to freak out about in the long hours before the main event begins, and Katie Brown starts yelling epithets of a caliber that suggests there's Irish in her family. Things really start getting good when she punches Rodney in the arm, and Rodney steps away, yelling vaguely encouraging things from a distance about the trajectory and velocity of objects meeting resistance and immovable force. John, who's gnawed his fingernails down to the quick already, makes a split-second decision, runs out to the truck, pulls out the football that's jammed behind the driver's seat, and pounds back inside, glad to finally have something to do with his hands. He's glad he's not in California. He's pretty sure Katie wouldn't appreciate his quarterback stance as he watches, or his suggestion she go for a touchdown when the doctor tells her to push. But the analogy works for him, and he whoops and cheers like she's made third and down every time she sags back against the pillows. When the baby's head finally crowns, he gasps, appalled, winces, and shuffles his feet as the rest of the body appears, and breathes Hail Mary as the baby starts to cry. Rodney cuts the cord, and John laughs affectionately, crazily at the trembling in Rodney's hands and the look of wonder in his face. And when, minutes later, Rodney brings the baby over to the cam and murmurs, "Finn McKay," so that John knows his name, it's all John can do not to weep like a child himself. Instead, he throws the football across the room, breaks a lamp, and goes to fetch a beer, rubbing the heel of his hand across his aching heart the whole time. The next 12 days are a patchwork of hurried conversations and middle-of-the-night emails, none of which are particularly coherent on either end. It's hard to connect. Rodney's exhausted, sleeping when Finn sleeps, palming off his infant son on the administrative assistants in the department while he eviscerates his grad students and begrudgingly grants their PhDs, gabbling at John on his cell phone when he has a minute. He tries to explain.
"She just walked into my office. Enormous. Pregnant. And the math's not hard. 40 weeks. March, December. And I tried to sit down because everyone knows I have a trick knee under situations of grave stress, and I may have possibly missed the chair." And everything's peppered with a running commentary. "Please don't cry. Please don't. Oh no, that's a new will. Oh shit, what does that mean? Could you just skip all those really annoying milestones of human development and tell me what you need? Finn, please?"
By the time John drives Rodney's car to the airport to meet their flight, baby carrier strapped firmly into the back seat and shades on the side windows to keep off the sun, he's almost completely sure that throwing up would feel fantastic. The waiting's interminable. The flight lands. Passengers trickle into the concourse. But Rodney's not among them, and the trickle abates long before he hears Rodney bitching at the hapless airport staff about the soulless idiots who own the airlines. When Rodney finally rounds the corner, John realizes why it took him this long. He's hauling his laptop case, his bag, a large quilted tote the size of a small house, has a bottle of formula clasped awkwardly in one hand, a magazine under his arm, and of course, there's Finn, fast asleep in his baby carrier. John struck dumb.
"Hi," Rodney says tentatively, coming to a halt a good 5 steps away. John clears his throat.
"Hi."
"He's sleeping."
"I can see that.
Can I?" John wets his lips nervously and steps forward, takes the baby carrier out of Rodney's hand, and sets it gently on the floor, crouches beside it.
"Hey, buddy," he whispers, touching the back of one of Finn's hands.
Finn squirms a little, but carries on sleeping, and John realizes he's in a whole world of trouble where his heart's concerned.
So,
Rodney sets down all his other bags. He looks miserable, anxious. John looks up.
"God, I missed you," he murmurs, and stands, tugs Rodney into a rough, graceless hug, and holds on until he feels Rodney's arms come up to hug him back.
They stand there for a long moment, quiet, holding on what feels like for dear life, Finn sleeping beside their feet. Rodney balks for a moment in the parking lot when he realizes John didn't bring the truck.
It's just... No, I get it. You're right. It's just it's always been the truck. And he's deathly quiet on the drive home, dozing against the passenger window, occasionally turning to check Finn's okay. John feels like someone's thrust a turnkey into his back, slowly tightening a spring inside him as though he's some clockwork toy ready to perform. But he keeps his silence since he's no idea when Rodney last slept, and it seems like a good idea to let Finn sleep too. Back at the farm, he lets Rodney scoop Finn out of the baby carrier, contents himself with hauling in the luggage, the other baby seat, the diaper bag, the laptop case. Upstairs, he says to Rodney as he sets everything down in the kitchen. I bought a crib. You didn't have to. Rodney, go put the kid down. He gives Rodney a minute, then climbs the stairs himself, makes his way to the spare room that he spent the last 12 days transforming. Rodney's standing in the middle of the room, Finn still in his arms, gaping, wide-eyed, as he takes everything in. Is it okay? John asks. Okay, Rodney manages. It's a room that was painted cream the last time Rodney saw it. A full-sized bed covered in a patchwork quilt and bookcases against the wall filled with equal parts junk and ancient editions of National Geographic. Now the room's blue, sky blue on the walls, the night sky on the ceiling, with a crib and a changing table, a dresser and a toy chest. There are blocks by the window, and a bear by the door, and the rocking chair John's been building piece by piece is set in the corner with the lamp at its side. I mean, I didn't ask if it was okay, the colors and the... John ambles across the room, sets the airplane mobile spinning above the crib. I never imagined... I can't believe you. John turns, and Rodney's deathly pale, so he moves quickly, scoops Finn out of his arms, and nudges Rodney back toward the chair. Head, knees, he says, and shifts to settle Finn in his crib. Runs a gentle hand over the shock of dark hair sticking up every which way on the top of Finn's head. He has my hair, he laughs softly. Rodney laughs brokenly. It's gonna be okay, you know, John offers. Rodney looks up. I can almost believe that, he says strangled, except I haven't had any coffee. John smiles and tugs him up out of the chair, grabs the portable baby monitor from the bookshelf, and heads downstairs. He busies himself with the coffee pot, pulls out the really good Hawaiian beans, lets Rodney sit at the kitchen table and take everything in. John? Hmm? You... There's the scrape of a chair, and John turns to see Rodney cross to the stove. The coffee can's back on the shelf above the spices, a new strip of tape stuck to the front, with Finn inked in big black letters where bike used to be. Rodney looks at him, amazement on his face, and barely fumbles the coffee can to the stove top before he reaches out, pulls John close, and kisses him sloppily, warm and tense. John lets himself be backed up against the kitchen counter, slips his hands into the back pockets of Rodney's jeans, welcomes the scrape of Rodney's stubble against his jaw. They'll make it work, he thinks. He's certain. Knows it from the pressure inside of his chest. And if he can't quite say the words yet, can't quite vocalize how he feels, he can offer up new paint and a spare room and a coffee can above the stove. And maybe Rodney'll work out that he loves him back.